On this episode of Chapters, we talk about the role of reading in our lives.
But I think we still go to reading, whether it's reading about a historical period or historical person, to make sense of ourselves and the present.
My guest today is Thomas Lawrence Long, Associate Professor in Nursing at the University of Connecticut School of Nursing, where he studies and teaches on medical humanities and health studies, the history of nursing, AIDS and culture, and rhetoric and academic writing. On today's show, we cover a range of topics reflecting the diversity of Tom's experiences, from treasured books from childhood to the queerness of Sherlock Holmes, the Gospels and narrative theory, and beyond. This is Tom's story. Okay, so thank you so much for speaking with me today. I so appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to begin by asking what I ask everyone, which is, what's your earliest memory of reading?
My earliest memory of reading is a brief quatrain, four-line poem, which I committed to memory and I remember to this day. And it goes like this. Beside the bunny, place your feet, wash hands and face, be clean and neat. That little four-line poem was painted on a red stool in our family bathroom when I was growing up in the 1950s. And there was a little bunny painted on there as well. And as I memorized that poem and stood on the bunny washing hands and face to be clean and neat. And as I've thought about that stool and about that bunny over the years, over the decades, it eventually occurred to me that it was a terrific demonstration of what the Roman poet Horace had said are the two purposes of poetry, and by extension, the two purposes of literature, and by extension, the two purposes of reading, to delight and to instruct. And so the poem is delightful in its simple quatrain way. And of course, it was instructing me. And I think that early experience, I think, imprinted on me both the ways in which reading can delight and teach. And just as a side note, by the way, a few months ago, rummaging around an antique store in Manchester, Connecticut, I came across an old, beat-up red stool with the bunny and the quatrain painted on it. Yes, so it's now in my bathroom.
That's amazing. What a full circle moment.
No, really.
So it's interesting that you kind of have this nostalgic first memory of reading in an instructive way. I have one like that too, that I had a plaque on my childhood bedroom wall that said a prayer. I think was raised in a Catholic home.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering where you grew up and what your family was like.
Sure. I grew up in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. My father had been born in Washington. My mother had been born in Atlanta, Georgia, but had moved to Washington, D.C. When she was a child. It was a pretty typical 1950s suburban aspiring middle-class home, and it was a home with books, because both of my parents are avid readers. Well, my mother has passed away, but both of them were avid readers, and both of them had textbooks from their childhood, like high school textbooks, particularly anthologies of prose and poetry. And they were avid readers of history, which you will appreciate, and of biography, but also of more traditional literature, poetry, fiction, drama. So I grew up in a home with books and people who read.
And what do you remember them reading to you when you were very young?
Well, you know, there was, I can remember all the sort of standard traditional folktale kinds of books and Hans Christian Andersen. My father's favorite story, and he would read it to us often, and he would usually read it to us when my mother was in earshot, was a story in which the tagline, it's about an old man and an old woman, husband and wife, and the husband keeps doing things that don't seem sensible but eventually turn out okay. And the old woman keeps saying, "Whatever the old man does is right." So this was, my father loved reading that story to us. And as I say, we'd always make sure that my mother was, it was an earshot. My father went to college when I was in grade school. So he went part-time to Montgomery College and then to the University of Maryland. So he graduated from the University of Maryland when I graduated from eighth grade. And while he was at the University of Maryland, he studied French. So he used to read French poetry, children's poetry, to my brothers and sister as bedtime reading. So I have a very sweet memory of him reading to them in French, which probably prompted my interest in studying French in high school and college.
So before then, before high school and college, what were the books that, when you transitioned from being read to reading yourself, what were the books that really made an influential impact on you as a reader?
Volcanoes. I consumed, so I went through several stages, and I think most children do.
Okay.
So my first stage was volcanoes. I couldn't get my hands on enough books about volcanoes. And then I had sort of subsidiary interests in geology and in paleontology, fossils. Then in 1962, my father took me over to the dedication of Dulles Airport, the new Dulles Airport, which was this 21st century airport in 1962. And we had an opportunity to board planes, to get on planes, the, you know, tour planes that were there. And this was the first time I had ever been that close to a plane. So then I became fascinated with flight and planes. But being a boy, I was particularly fascinated with air disasters. So I couldn't get my hands on enough books about air disasters. I think my father was, well, I know my father was concerned about the narrowness of my reading tastes. And so I remember quite vividly one time he took me to the regional library. We had a very good regional library. To find a book that he felt would be more broadening. So he found a book on Amerigo Vespucci, which, of course, I did not read. That was my form of resistance. I might have read the first page or so, but none of that interested me. I was interested in volcanoes and air disasters.
I mean, how could anything compete with that?
You know, it was history in the making, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or prehistory in the making in some cases.
So what got you off those interests? How long were you into that? And then what comes next for you?
Well, what came next for me was a couple of things. So when I was in fourth grade, I went to a Catholic parochial school, and the school was sponsoring a kind of book service where you could order, I don't know, maybe a book a month or something like that, and for 50 cents you'd get, or 25 cents you'd get a book, paperback book. And so the first book I ever bought was James Hilton's The Lost Horizon, the story of explorers getting lost and wandering into the enchanted city of Shangri-La, where people are eternally young and never die.
Hmm.
And so there was something really interesting about this fictional world, a sustained fictional world. And this, of course, you know, for a fourth grader, this is a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a fourth grader, this is kind of sophisticated stuff. This sustained fictional world. The next year, I was in fifth grade, and this was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And so I became fascinated with his life, fascinated with his history, the history of World War II. And my father, of course, had served in World War II. And so he had some books about World War II. And so I was reading those as well.
And would he talk about his service with you?
Not particularly. Like a lot of men of that generation, there are two kinds of responses that men of his generation had to World War II. His response was, I did that because it was my duty to do that. I mean, he left high school. He did not graduate from high school in order to enlist. He was 17 when he enlisted in the Navy. So for some men, it was, we're just doing our duty. And now life goes on, and my life now is more important. Then, of course, there are other men for whom it was the most important thing that they had ever done. Everything was downhill from then.
Hmm.
Despite the fact that, as I learned years later, my father's, he was a radio man on a torpedo bomber, aircraft carrier-based torpedo bomber, and the plane had to ditch in the South Pacific. And he rescued one of the fellow crewmen. But this was not something he talked about.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about JFK's assassination mm-hmm. as potentially this entree point. You're mm-hmm. seeking out books on mm-hmm. Kennedy. You're seeking mm-hmm. out books on World War II that mm-hmm. I would think that would be a point when your father might share with you.
Yeah, not particularly. And both of my parents were very politically astute, politically alert. So it wasn't that they were apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was simply feeling that he was just doing his duty, and there was nothing more to say about it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that part of the way that you dealt with this national grief as a child mm-hmm. was to seek out information.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, absolutely.
And
understanding.
Yeah.
Instruction. To delight and to instruct. And
yes.
So instruction. Let me learn. Let me have an informed context for what's just happened.
But also that you were in a Catholic school, mm-hmm. and that's also a means of understanding. And, you know, I went to Catholic school too
right.
growing up.
Right.
The kind of reading that you do there is in some ways meant to be an explanatory framework for things like tragedies and just
yeah,
parts of life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're of a different generation, but I grew up in a generation of the catechism,
mm-hmm.
Which there were questions and answers, questions and answers, and things were all spelled out very clearly.
Right.
Although at this point, by the mid-60s, the Roman Catholic Church had begun to undergo significant changes as a result of the Reform Council, the Second Vatican Council. But it's also a very text-based community. And so reading the lives of the saints, for example, which frankly are more fiction than fact.
Yeah. I remember being in, so I moved into a Catholic school in fourth grade, mm. and I'd gone mm-hmm. to public school previous to this. And I was handed The Lives of the Saints when I started Catholic school mm-hmm. by a very wonderful teacher who mm-hmm. Made a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading these stories and thinking, okay, there's stories here about, you know, murders, mm-hmm. martyrdom, mm-hmm.
torture,
rape, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to watch. I can't watch mm-hmm. Grease mm-hmm. at my house.
Right.
Because that's inappropriate.
Right.
But I can right. read this book.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Real potboilers. to this day, my favorite is St. Christina the Astonishing, who was so disgusted and offended by the smell of mortal flesh that when required to be in a church, she would fly to the rafters. She would levitate and fly to the rafters to get away from people.
Well, I think we've all been there.
We have been, but I've never developed the skill, I guess because of my insufficient holiness, never developed the
That's
skill
right.
of levitation.
But those stories are amazing because they cultivate your sense of wonder.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's kind of the contrast to reading about JFK and reading mm-hmm. about airline mm-hmm. disasters is that...
Well, yeah, these are exemplary lives, exemplary people, exemplary events.
And tragedy without explanation.
Right.
So when JFK is assassinated, you know, I've spoken to other people who also have very mm-hmm. strong memories of that day mm-hmm. and that time. And mm-hmm. just as a child, you want answers, like mm-hmm. the Baltimore Catechism that tells you, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. why does hell exist?
Mm-hmm.
Answer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. XYZ.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also this was a period in which we were entering the Vietnam War. Its ambiguity had not yet become clear to us.
Mm-hmm.
We had become, I think, sort of detached from the ambiguity and the irresolution of the Korean War. The civil rights movement had begun, so there was, you know, a context for social dissent and seismic shifts in social values that were rumbling beneath the surface.
Hmm.
And so sometimes these, well, you know, the American imagination is deeply invested in typology. The notion that past events can help us make sense of present events, that we make sense of the present by reference to past precedents. And in American history and literature and culture, we've often employed the typological imagination. If you think, for example, about the Tea Party movement of the last 8 years or so, clearly, they're employing the typological imagination, the typology of an event that occurred in the 1770s,
mm-hmm.
and associating themselves with that event and making sense of the present in light of that past historical precedent.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting way of creating an identity.
Well, and I think we also read that way. And I think that's why biography is often so popular among readers in the United States. Now, I've never been a big reader of biographies. I'm always been more interested in sort of the historical synthesis, big picture, rather than individual lives. But I think we still go to reading, whether it's reading about a historical period or historical person, to make sense of ourselves and the present.
Mm-hmm.
Can I tell you more about my further history as
please,
a reader?
Please
okay?
do.
Because by the time I graduated from eighth grade, and was preparing to enter a Catholic male prep school. When I graduated, I received, as one does, monetary gifts. And I used them to buy books. This was my first encounter with the wonderful world of remaindered hardbacks. And so whereas before I had been able to purchase for 25 or 50 cents some cheap pulp paperback versions of books like The Lost Horizon, Now I was able to buy hardback, cloth-bound books. And among the books I bought was the complete edition of Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories, which I devoured, consumed. But also the Gargantua and Pantagruel narratives of François Rabelais, 16th century, bawdy 16th century writer, and in which, of course, Rabelais creates this wonderful fictional world of these two giants, a king and his son, the prince. They're giants. Gargantua is the father, Pantagruel is the son. And the various adventures they have and the people they encounter, and the wonderful Abbey of Thelem, headed by the monk Friar John of the Funnels, so-called because of his capacious thirst. And the abbey has as its motto, "Do what you will." So it's a wonderful satire. It's a wonderful satire of political life in the 16th century and of religious life. And of course, it's a book that I think ended up on the Index of Forbidden Books.
I think so. So can I ask you, what, if you're looking back now, what drew you to that book and what did it do for you? With the benefit of hindsight, what did that do for you?
I was drawn to that book because of my parents, in an oddly indirect sort of way. My parents were both very sensible people, my mother more so than my father. So when they married, they decided that they were going to take their savings and not put it in a honeymoon. They were going to take their savings and put it in the down payment on a house. So the day they were married, they moved into our first house. So when I was about four, they went on a delayed honeymoon. Just the two of them, aunt of mine, my father's sister, took care of me for a long weekend. And they saw all kinds of shows. They went to New York and they saw all kinds of shows. They saw the original cast of The Music Man and My Fair Lady. And so growing up, I grew up in a house that wasn't just filled with books. It was also filled with music, classical music, opera, choral music, but also Broadway show cast albums, including The Music Man. And you'll remember that The Music Man involves a love interest between a scoundrel, a con man, Professor Harold Hill, and the town librarian, Marion Perdue. And the gossipy women of the city have a song called Pick a Little, Talk a Little, one of those sort of comic songs that appear often in Broadway musicals. They're complaining that the wealthy man of the town has made a bequest to the town after his death. And they sing, "He left River City the library building, but he left all the books to her." This is to Marion. So she owns the books. The city owns, the town owns the library building. And then they go on to list some of the horrific writers. Rabelais, Chaucer, Balzac. Now, I've never read Balzac, I have to confess, but read lots of Chaucer in college and in graduate school. But it was that song that got me interested in Rabelais, because I figured, well, if it was scandalous to the women of River City, Iowa, it must be significant. There's something I want to read. At the same time, I also bought Tolstoy's War and Peace. And so that summer, the summer after eighth grade, and then into the next year, I was reading these, you know, very massive books. And will admit to skipping parts of War and Peace. I was much more interested sort of in the love affair than in Tolstoy's theorizing about stuff.
So what did that do for you, all of this reading?
Well, I think it was delight. It was delight. Certainly for me, as a very bookish, intellectually precocious boy, Sherlock Holmes provided me with a kind of role model. And also, as a little queer boy, without consciously quite understanding what that was and what that meant in terms of sexual identity, a sustained series of narratives about two men who live together in this kind of idealized bachelor flat seemed like a wonderful way to live. And I know later I was struck by the same dynamic or the same domestic arrangement in Shaw's Pygmalion, which of course then was made into the musical My Fair Lady, in which you have Henry Higgins and Colonel Pickering living together in this sort of domestic bliss, albeit with Eliza Doolittle. So that I think for me provided me with a kind of non-erotic model of male companionship in creating this fictional world in which knowledge, intellectual knowledge, was power. I was no good at sports. I could dismantle things. I built a radio. You used to be able to buy kits to build radios, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't build a radio from scratch. So I could build a radio, use a soldering iron, but sort of other kinds of, and friends of mine and I used to build forts out of scrap lumber that we stole from building sites, home construction sites. But I wasn't good at sports and a lot of other physical activities. So the notion that knowledge, intellectual knowledge, could be power, which is certainly the case with Sherlock Holmes, I think was both instructive. It taught me, as well as delighting me in the creation of that fictional world.
Do you think that both this sense that intellectual knowledge is power and that you might find books that offer a kind of escape for someone who may have queer desires, mm-hmm. even if you can't mm-hmm. articulate them mm-hmm. yet, did that help you get through high school?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of typically an awkward time for a lot of people.
Oh, sure. And you know, growing sexual awareness. Certainly all of the confusion of going to an all-male prep school.
Yeah, what was that like?
Well, that's a subject for a private podcast.
Oh boy.
Well, no, it's not. I'm not in that way. No, I was not. I was precocious intellectually, not sexually, but certainly deeply conflicting. You know, lots of crushes,
that
you can't act on or articulate or even acknowledge.
Did you know at that time that you were gay?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I had known from maybe eighth grade that I was attracted to other boys.
Okay.
And that my interest and inclinations were not like most other boys. And so, so someone like Sherlock Holmes, who is queer in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
He's odd. He's, you know, we have a tendency nowadays to do literary diagnosis on him and, you know, claim him for the Asperger's spectrum. but he's odd. Well, frankly, it was also appealing the notion that it was appealing that that he had no visible means of support. I mean, he didn't have a job. And his brother Mycroft sort of worked for the government, I guess, but they seemed to have independent sources of income, which was very
no
appealing
clue
to
where
me.
His income was coming from.
Yeah.
He's always on some kind of drug, unapologetically.
Well, right. The 7% solution of cocaine. Which poor Watson was.
He knows enough of manners, but rejects them out of
rejects
hand.
Them, a lot like Henry Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
Who later will complain that he treats all people the same way, which is to say he treats people badly.
Mm-hmm.
He and Holmes are very similar in a number of interesting respects. One is a detective of crime; the other is a detective of language. But once again, the capacity for a special knowledge, special expertise, to be a kind of wizard or mandarin intellectually. I would imagine that is analogous to what a lot of younger readers find appealing about Harry Potter, is this notion of knowledge, special knowledge, acquired, developed, and that knowledge can be powerful.
Mm.
And especially when you're not feeling particularly autonomous or powerful, that I think has a very is consoling. So literature as delight, and related to that delight is consolation.
Hmm. Now I'm wondering, did it help you at all? Did your reading life help you at all when you're in high school and you're thinking about what you want to do next, or?
It did, in fact, but my career interests changed dramatically from the time I was what would have then be middle school, what would now be middle school age. I had become interested in marine biology and oceanography, and I mean I had become quite focused on that. And so reading books about the sea and about biology and the life of the sea, and Rachel Carson and Jacques-Yves Cousteau's books were part of my reading repertoire in 6th, 7th, 8th grade.
Mm.
And that continued, and I continued to be interested in science. Which has certainly helped me in my current work here, providing writing support services to the UConn School of Nursing researchers. A couple of things happened in high school. I had to take algebra, and it was a disaster. Break out into a cold sweat today thinking about algebra. So,
Me too.
There's that association with science and scientific statistical knowledge and being able to manipulate statistics. But then the other thing was I had some really good history teachers and English teachers who delighted in literature in a way that I had not experienced before. These were also men. Keep in mind, grades K through 8 for me had been exclusively women teachers. So these are men, and men who love literature and who took delight in it and who had favorite poems or favorite fictions or favorite writers. And I mean, even as late as my senior year in high school, I was still thinking about marine biology, and I was still, when I was applying to college in my senior year, I was still, you know, checking off biology, but the conversion was already happening.
Hmm.
to literature and literary studies. And I was doing some writing as well. That was the other thing, was that I was had a notebook in which I was writing fictions, usually spy fictions, because this, of course, was the emergence of secret agent films and television shows, mid to late 60s, and the James Bond films. So probably one of my greatest delights in my junior year, we were required as an English assignment to write a narrative, a brief narrative, fictional narrative. And so I wrote a fictional narrative in the style of Ian Fleming, James Bond. I had been reading some of the James Bond novels, which were probably not appropriate for a Catholic prep school boy in the late 60s, but anyway. And my teacher, I remember this very vividly, my teacher pulled me aside after class, very serious, and said, "Did you plagiarize this?" And of course, at first I panicked, but then when I assured him, I wrote that myself, then the delight flooded in, because I thought, I fooled him. I was able to absorb what I had read and imitate the style sufficiently that he thought I had plagiarized it. How wonderful. How wonderful that you can satirize, imitate a style, that you can have a style, that you can develop a style. So I think there was I was beginning to have a sense that not only the narrative and the characters, the events, the plot, but also the style of language could be a source of attention and delight.
Yeah, it's amazing that what a compliment to you that you could write a James Bond style so well that you fooled your teacher.
I know.
What a thrill.
Yeah, I mean, of course it was just like a couple of handwritten pages, but still, I could not have produced a sustained performance.
Wow. So, what's the next influential period of your life as a reader?
Next influential life.
So you're in college now.
Now I'm in college, right. And I'm now an English major.
Okay.
Yeah. I had taken advanced placement English. And so I tested out, as a result of my AP test, I tested out of the, really basically the first 2 years of the standard English program, including the sophomore survey course, which I eventually did take, but I took it in my senior year because I went to the Catholic University of America, which at the time still had a comprehensive exam, a written comprehensive exam for the bachelor's degree.
So at the end of your 4 years, you'd have to take a written exam.
Yes. You don't get your degree until you've taken and passed your written comprehensive exam.
That's terrifying.
It was terrifying. So I figured at some point I figured out, this actually would be kind of helpful to have a to take now the sophomore survey course in my senior year, though I don't need it for the credit, as a kind of preparation for the comps. So instead, I jump right into the senior Shakespeare course, and which was terribly taught by a sweet man named Kirby Neal, who could be easily distracted and would digress. But I was also in, I also placed out of intermediate French, because I had had 3 years of French in high school, placed out of intermediate French into a two-semester survey of French literature, with a wonderful scholar named William Willimon. And Willimon had an acquaintanceship with Kenneth Clark, Lord Clark, the British art historian who just a few years before had written the book and produced the television series for BBC called Civilization. And it was a groundbreaking television series. Presented and narrated by Clark himself. It was called Civilization, A Personal View. And so for me, there was this notion that music, art, architecture, history, and literature were all tied up with each other in this thing called culture or civilization. These are terms that we are less likely to use as naively as we did in the late 60s, early 70s. But Willimon was friends with Clark, and so outside of class, he would show us each episode, if we wanted to come. He'd show us each episode, and we'd have these informal conversations up in his office. And he would relate to his conversations he had had with Kenneth Clark. And some years later, he arranged for Clark to be a commencement speaker at Catholic U. And so I think for me, his exploration of French literature opened up new worlds. The poet Stéphane Mallarmé, late 19th, early 20th century poet, sort of blew the top of my head off with his poem, whose title is Un coup de dé jamais n'abolira pas le hasard. A toss of the dice will never abolish chance. And this poem is an extraordinary poem because it's an extraordinary... do you know the poem?
I don't.
You should take a look at the poem because it cries out for a digital humanities treatment if it's not already been done. Because the poem explodes the text across multiple pages with the left-hand verso page and the right-hand recto page. You're actually reading across the two pages as you go through the poem. And large type, small type, type scattered all over the page. And we're talking about, you know, late 1800s, early 20th century. In a sense, he created 20th century literature single-handedly. So for me, this was the same thing that Rabelais had done. Can you do that? Can you do that in a book? You can do that in a book. Can you do that in a poem? Yes, you can do that in a poem. Later in graduate school, I would have the same experience with reading Lawrence Stern's novel, 18th century British novel, Tristram Shandy. And it's a delightful, basically a shaggy dog story in which the entire novel, we are promised to be told something, but the novel wanders around and never gets to the point and constantly digresses. And one of the things that Stern will do periodically is he will do things like, I'm just skipping the next chapter because it wasn't very interesting and we're going on to the following chapter. And so he skips chapter 23 and we go right on to chapter 24. I don't remember if that's exactly the number. Or he provides a line drawing of the plot, which, of course, is this squiggly line drawing. You know, he stops the prose narrative to have this squiggly line drawing. He has a page in which, and I've forgotten now why, a page in which it's just black ink. He was at the moment when the English novel is being created, in a sense, he's creating the postmodern novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right there. And it's like, oh, can you do that in a book? Yes, you can do that in a book. Oh, wow. So,
it feels like you're drawn to a lot of transgressive literature when you're in college, whether it's the form that it's itself transgressive or the content. And you're there in college in the late 60s.
Early 70s.
Early 70s.
Graduated from high school in 71, so early 70s.
But you're at Catholic U.
Yeah.
And at this point, you know that you're gay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how does this all, like, what's going on with you in college?
Well, I was living in an intentional Christian community with three other men. All of us were discerning religious vocations.
Okay.
We lived together for 2 years, our sophomore and junior year. Toward the end of which I came out to them, which was very awkward.
How did that go?
Well, they were unsettled. They were not quite sure how to respond. They were not critical. It took me a couple of decades to realize why they were unsettled, because two out of those three were gay themselves. So
what?
So why they were? we drifted apart at the end of college. We were in touch. The third of these was a ragingly heterosexual guy, and the three gay men. We got together at his wedding, and then completely lost touch. And I got in touch with these two guys years later, mid-90s. I tracked them down using whatever the web search engine was at that time. It wasn't Google, but it was something else. And one of them and I keep in touch quite regularly on Facebook now. He and his husband live in New York City.
So I was going to ask if they're both still priests. I guess not.
Well, they never went on. They never went on.
Got
they
it.
They were never they never went on. One of them went on to Columbia University and has been a sociology professor out in the American Southwest. And the other has been a school administrator. Mm. In New York, so I was the only one who went on for ordination.
Wow!
Yeah,
I mean, are you willing to talk about sort of that
sure.
process and
sure.
what that was like
sure.
for you?
And... Went on well. So in as an undergraduate, I became deeply interested. Well, let me. As an undergraduate, I became deeply interested in medieval studies. And so anyway, that when I went to graduate school, then that was my focus. I went to the University of Illinois, and so medieval and Renaissance studies were my focus there.
Okay.
And it was from there that what I had been discerning and feeling and thinking about, really pondering since childhood, this call to a religious vocation in the Catholic Church. Finally, by the time I was finishing up my master's degree, I decided I wanted to go to the seminary. So came back to Catholic U and was in the seminary for 4 years, earned a master's degree, wrote a master's thesis in which I took the work in narrative theology, which was flourishing in the 1970s. I took the work of John S. Dunn, a Notre Dame theologian, and I showed parallels with his narrative theology and reader response criticism from the 1960s and 70s. So I was drawing, you know, explicit connections. There is still a paper there that I want to publish, and I intend to publish, because I think that's an interesting moment in terms of narrative, the marriage of theology and narrative. And that was that deeply informed my own theological thought and my pastoral work as a priest, ordained as a priest in 1981.
So what kinds of work were you doing in your
narrative
pastoral work?
Okay. It was just normal parish work, but the notion that narrative, that story, narrative theology, that story and narrative might be ways of leaping over doctrinal disagreements and doctrinal obstacles. If we could simply be attentive to not only the biblical stories, both the narratives and the narratives in the narratives, Jesus' parables, for example. And there had been, by this point in the 1970s, there had been considerable scholarly, biblical scholarly work about parables and about the rhetorical and literary dimensions of Jesus's parables. And the parable, you know, the parables historically had been, for many centuries, had been treated largely as simply moral allegories. They are there to teach you a lesson. Once you've learned the lesson, you can discard the parable. But what biblical scholars from the mid-20th century on were beginning to appreciate was the extent to which the parables that Jesus tells, those little stories, were unusually destabilizing and unsettling and transgressive and not consoling.
Can you give me an example?
Well, sure. When most people think of the parable of the Good Samaritan, what do they take away from the parable of the Good Samaritan? Now remember, this is a story about a guy who, a man who's traveling to Jerusalem, and he is attacked by robbers, and he's left bloody and lying in the on the road, and a Pharisee comes along the road and sees him, but doesn't stop to help him. And then a Levite comes along and sees him, and then doesn't stop to help him and moves on. And they're all heading to Jerusalem. And it's the Samaritan who sees him, stops, binds his wounds, takes him to an inn, pays the innkeeper, says, "I'll check back on him on my way back." So that remember, is the parable. So what do most people take away from the parable of the Good Samaritan?
Isn't the lesson that you shouldn't discriminate?
Well, and usually don't they, and in fact, we have what are called Good Samaritan laws, right? So usually what people take away from the parable of the Good Samaritan is you should help people in need. That's the moral of the parable. No. That's only if you're reading it as a moral allegory. It has nothing to do with telling you how you should take care of people who are hurt. It has to do with the fact that devout Orthodox Jews in first century Palestine hated Samaritans. And so the good person in the story is not the Pharisee, is not the Levite. It's this despised, deplorable Samaritan. Because the question Jesus is asking there is, who is the neighbor? Who should we consider the neighbor? And it's not the conventional, orthodox, religiously sanctimonious, upright person. It's not the Pharisee, it's not the Levite. It's the despised Samaritan. Parables turn the world upside down. They're deeply subversive, deeply unsettling. So that's the insight of narrative theology. That and other parables as often said, the gospel is a comfort to the afflicted and an affliction to the comfortable. And so stories here are shaking us up. They're destabilizing. But notice how in the conventional preaching tradition, the story of the Good Samaritan almost invariably comes out to, you should always take care of people in need. No, that's not what it's about at all. And notice that's even ensconced in our in the name we use to protect health professionals from liability if they stop to take care of someone who's injured. Okay, if a health professional sees somebody who's been in an accident, stops to help them, they can't be held liable if some problem occurs. And those laws that protect them from professional liability are called Good Samaritan laws, which, of course, is that complete misreading of the parable, which is not about taking care of people who are hurt. It's about your neighbor is the person you despise.
So was your role as a priest then to kind of read those stories and point the people whom you're serving to the transgressive lessons therein?
That's what I did.
Okay.
And usually I preached, you know, it is said that we best preach what we most need to learn. And so I would start from many of the things that I was struggling with. I wasn't out as a gay man to my congregations during the 80s, mostly as a courtesy to them, but I was very clear about answering how I answered the question, who is my neighbor? Who did Jesus hang out with? And so my preaching would come from, you know, people's, I tried to make it come from my real life and my real struggles and their real lives and their real struggles. And looking for ways in which we could be shaken up.
And did working as a priest and this obligation to preach, did that inspire you to read in new or different ways?
Oh, it certainly did, because, you know, then that meant, for example, I'm not sure new ways. I had always been a studious reader since late in college. Keep in mind that I'm of that generation that was an English major when there were modernist poets still alive. and so the modernist poetry with its difficult, complex, obscure allusions and references, the need to read modernist poetry or modernist fiction, almost as a rabbi would read a sacred text, had already been inculcated in me. So as a preacher, I would bring a depth of understanding, not only what do biblical scholars say today about this particular reading that's assigned for this Sunday, but also within the hermeneutic tradition, within the interpretive tradition, what is the history of this interpretation? So there were a number of ways that I could look at patristic early church fathers to see how were they reading this? How was the early church reading this? How in other moments of history were we reading this particular text?
Yeah, and I'm wondering, because you're not sharing with your parishioners that you're out, or you're not out to them, I should say, and you're a priest in the 80s during the AIDS crisis, which is, I know, something that you've gone on to work on quite a bit. What was that like for you? And
well, I was I had in the early mid 80s, I had moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and became the chaplain to the Catholic gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender group called Dignity, which was part of a national group at that time. I became their chaplain, and very quickly was involved in AIDS ministry, because I was one of a few clergy who could be reliably called upon to minister to, it was mostly men, to gay men and their partners and their families at a moment of crisis, usually in hospitalization. And so, you know, and of course, I, as a younger man, had done things intimately that put me at risk for HIV infection. And in the 80s, I was among those who were often referred to as the worried well, you know, a bad case of influenza. Oh, my gosh, what is this it? And at that point, it took several years before there was the antibodies test to determine if you'd been infected with HIV. And there was a considerable debate about whether or not you should even take the test because, well, there's nothing we can do about it anyway. And so it was a period of tremendous sadness. I lost a lot of dear friends, a lot of dear people, to whom I dedicated my book, AIDS and American Apocalypticism, a book I researched in the mid-90s and then published in 2005.
And as you're grieving, are you turning towards anything in your reading life to help you understand what you're witnessing when you're counseling families and loved ones and people living with AIDS, dying from it? And just yourself, taking care of yourself through that experience.
Well, I you know, there is a whole, you know, there's a whole pastoral care tradition in the Catholic Church aimed at providing consolation and healing to those who are sick. And my own historical reading, my own reading of the history of the, for example, the development of the sacrament of the sick, the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. How does that emerge out of some Jewish practices chronicled in biblical texts? How does that emerge in the early church? How does that develop over years? Eventually, it becomes sort of corrupted into the so-called last rites. But the sacrament of the sick was restored as a sacrament of the living, not of the dying, by the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. So I was the beneficiary of that sacramental tradition that enabled me to ritualize healing for people. And so we would periodically, within this monthly meeting of the chapter of the Dignity group, we would periodically do healing services, anointing with chrism, a holy oil, and laying on of hands in that sacramental ritual of the Catholic Church.
So where do you go next in your journey? You're still a priest in the through the 80s?
Through the 80s. Well, until 88. I left the priesthood in 88 and left the Catholic Church a short time thereafter. I was always a scholarly priest, and so my inclination when I left the priesthood was to turn back to academia. And was within a year of leaving the priesthood, I was able to secure a full-time position in an English department at a community college in Virginia. And around that time, began to think that it was that it was a good idea to explore a PhD in English. And this was around the time of the publication of, or at least the publicizing of, the Bowen Report, early 90s, a report, a kind of demographic analysis that suggested that the older baby boomers, older baby boomer professors who had entered the professoriate in the late 60s, early 70s, were about to retire, and the baby boomers' babies were now about to begin to enter college age. So a wave of retirements and a wave of new students was going to produce a golden age of full-time faculty positions in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So we should start working on cranking out some PhDs. And as I think you know, that didn't happen. I've just been interviewed by Vimal Patel, a journalist from the Chronicle of Higher Education, about this Bowen Report. He's been working on this article for some time. And so that didn't happen. And I don't know if we want to digress into why that didn't happen. But anyway, I went on to do a PhD. And because I already had a full-time job and I already had a full-time mortgage, I decided that I really couldn't afford to go to school full-time. You know, most PhD programs require you to go full-time for at least one academic year to fulfill the residency requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I found a PhD program at IUP, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, where a special summer program would allow you to go full-time during the summer to fulfill the residency requirement. It was also a program in which they were explicitly merging critical theory with the teaching of literature. Literary and critical and cultural theory had been hot in humanities circles in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, into the and throughout the 80s, I guess particularly from the 70s and 80s. And so this program at IUP was attempting to say, okay, we have this whole body of critical theory, but how do you integrate that into undergraduate teaching? And so it was a really good program. Most of the fellow students were all older, like me, had been teaching, had been reading for decades and decades. So small classes, small seminars, and a lifetime of reading. So it was very rich, a very good degree program.
So where do you go in your life as a reader after that? Is that like more recent times? Is that sort of your career? Because that's been your career trajectory since that program used to be in academia.
Yeah, I finished the PhD. So I was, you know, teaching full-time, regular academic year, going to classes in the summer. Finished the PhD in 97. Took this position at the University of Connecticut School of Nursing in 2008. So I was doing my own scholarship. I was publishing on literary and cultural representations of epidemic disease. I was publishing on HIV/AIDS and representations in literature and culture. Published my book in 2005. So I was shifting toward a kind of focus in what today we might call medical humanities or health humanities, an area with which you are intimately familiar as a historian. And so looking at the various ways that literature, film, media, other forms of cultural production represent health, illness, and health professions.
So by way of closing, I'm wondering if you could recommend something to our listeners that you've read recently and enjoyed.
Oh, gosh. You know, so much of my reading is sort of professional. And I guess I would say, well, you know, so I'm rereading. Well, you know what I'd say? Here's what I'd say. Reread something. That's what I'd recommend. Reread something. Reread something that gave you delight many years ago.
That's wonderful advice. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to thank our guest Tom for sharing his story with us. I'd also like to thank our producer Taylor for all of her help. You can find us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123 and Taylor at MJT the PhD. You can find us on Instagram at ChaptersPod. There you'll find shelfies submitted by our guests. Follow our page on Facebook and you can get updates on the show and join conversations about each episode with other listeners. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.